You're listening to the What Do You Actually Do podcast. Each week, we want to bring you an inspiring interview, a useful tip, or encouraging message to help you find your place in the professional world. Hello and welcome to this episode of What Do You Actually Do? My name's Kate Morris and I'll be your host today. In today's episode, we'll be talking about working in service design and design ethics. Today, we're joined by Kate Every, who works as a service design practice lead at Mastech, a tech services and consulting firm. So, Kate, what do you actually do?
I love this question because I very much often struggle to answer it. So maybe I'll start with what services are and then I'll go to service design itself. I think people often think of things in terms of products that we buy. They don't necessarily think of things in terms of services, which is kind of the overarching journey that you have to make from your initial decision to use something all the way through to having used it and what happens at the end of that. So a lot of what I do is kind of in government and healthcare. So a government service might be something like needing to get a passport. That whole process that you go through from filling out the forms to the online platforms that you use, taking a photo and then getting it returned to you in the post is a service, and that has to be designed. There is a process. So in government and healthcare, service designers look holistically at what people need to get from government and their government services and put the methods in place to help them get there, and whatever that might be. Yeah, a bit of a wordy answer there.
No, that's really useful. So it's having that bigger picture view of how to make something happen. And as you say, from the beginning to the end. So does Mastech, does it get contracts then from other organizations like government and healthcare to look at these things and deliver on them?
Yeah, so Mastech has a wide range of areas. So they do a lot of work in technology, so more of your kind of traditional thinking around kind of building IT systems. But we also have an element which is looking at what's called user-centered design, and that's roles like service design, user experience design, user research, and content design. And we are more focused on what users need from services. And this is really, really important in government. And government does work a lot with partners and consultancies to deliver this, to help their internal capabilities.
So can you talk me through what are the key elements of your role then as a service design practice lead?
Yeah, so I have two elements to my role. So there's the internal facing role within the consultancy. So I have kind of a small team of service designers who I support and mentor. And there's also a wider community, like I mentioned, the other people within our user-centered design community. And we get together every week to meet and kind of share best practice. But in the day-to-day, we're all kind of divided up and out on various projects in different clients, different companies. So I also act as a consultant. So I'll go out into, say, the NHS, and do service design projects, and they can look very, very different from one another. So I could maybe talk you through a couple of projects to give you an idea. But yeah, so the day-to-day is split between that internal element and the client-facing element.
Yeah, it'd be great to understand those examples of projects that you mentioned.
Yeah, so previously I was involved, prior to working at Mastech actually, but while I was still working in public sector consulting, I was involved in the COVID-19 test and trace team. So NHS Digital had to very, very quickly stand up a team of a huge number of people to build digital services and also offline services for people to be able to access testing. So if you remember at the time, you may have used some of the services like ordering a PCR test to your home, booking an appointment at a PCR test centre, or ordering some LFD kits to come so that you could take tests a few times a week, and filling out your results online. So there were all these kind of digital services, and I service designed the report of COVID-19 result service. So that was the one where you got an LFD test. You'd take it, find out what the result was, and then fill that out online to get further information and also kind of report back to the government so that they could collate that into their statistics. So as you can imagine, a huge amount goes into that because it was a service that was being used by kind of tens of millions of people a week, and it needed to work for them as best it could, but it also needed to work for government because the government needed access to statistics and things like that about how people were testing and what sort of roles they were in and how that might impact on how they were testing. So we had, I suppose, requirements from both sides, what the users needed, but also what government needed from that service. And yeah, so working with lots of different teams and doing lots of research with users to understand how that would work for them and to improve it over time as well. But that one was a particular challenge because obviously we were under immense time pressure. And yeah. Things changed week by week as kind of scientists learned more about the spread of the disease, government policy would change. So I'm sure you remember at the time, you know, first of all, there was no testing, and then there was PCR testing at test centres. And then they started bringing in things like LFD testing. And it did change really, really rapidly and many, many times. And every single time we had to kind of have a response to that in the service that we delivered to people as quickly as we could. So that one was a particular challenge, but a really interesting piece of work as well.
And important as well. That must have been like, it must have felt very rewarding to be actively helping in that way and doing something that's making a tangible difference to something that's happening to the whole of society.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it did feel like such an important piece of work to be involved in. And I think we all were very, very aware of that. It sometimes is difficult to be, I suppose, in the firing line, because as designers, particularly user-centered designers, you really care about doing the right thing for the users of the service, kind of the people who need a test, who might be ill at home and self-isolating. And we would be doing everything that we could to make sure that their needs were being met, but we were having to also deal with what was coming from the other side, which is actually kind of government policy or protection and healthcare. And, you know, there was data that was being asked for about people, so like where they were based, because the government wanted to know about prevalence in various regions. And we would sometimes hear in research from people who were incredibly frustrated with us and saying, why are you asking for this information? We don't want to give this information. Or, you know, other things. They were just frustrated and they then kind of were venting towards the researchers. And it is very difficult because you've got to be in that kind of middle position of wanting to advocate for the users, but also having to maintain a balance between all of the needs of the different stakeholders involved.
So are you literally looking at a project and thinking, right, there needs to be step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 to get to this end point? That's the whole picture. Or are you also writing the code and kind of making the technical side of it work? How does that work? You sort of, have you got the vision and then you're working with tech people to actually make it happen from a technical perspective, or are you doing both of those?
Yeah, so that's a really, really important question. I did listen to one of your previous podcast with somebody who works in agile delivery, so an agile delivery manager, and we work in agile teams as well. So we would have a delivery manager who's supporting the delivery of the project. We'd have a range of people from a design perspective, a research perspective, and also people who are technical, so who might be writing the code, they might be looking at the architecture, and also people who look at policy or prioritization and product. So it is very much a collaborative effort. You have to work together as a team. And that's one of the things I really love about it. Like, you start every day with kind of a 10-minute, what we call a stand-up, which is just a quick get together every day to say, what are we working on today? Are we still moving in the right direction? And then people go away and work on their particular parts. Or maybe, you know, there's lots of workshops that go on. There's a lot of collaborative working, but you do really need all of those voices and areas of expertise to be able to deliver something as kind of big as this. So yeah, we did have developers who were working on the code base. We had designers who were looking at how the screens would look and how the content worked, making sure that they were using content that made sense to people and also was not exclusive. And then service design is bringing all of that together by looking holistically. Where do we need to be interacting with different teams? Where do we hand off between our service and another service? What might the flow of the entire journey look like? So service design can fill a lot of different gaps. I kind of see the role as being a facilitator, because sometimes you need to get really down to the nitty-gritty and design the steps bit by bit if you're really kind of nose to the grindstone working in quite a small team. Other times you've got that really zoomed out view and you're looking at it a lot more at the kind of macro level. So it can change. The scope changes very much project to project. And again, that's another thing that I really love about the role.
Yeah, it must be intellectually really kind of challenging and interesting to sort of have both that macro and micro view, as you say.
Yeah.
So where did your interest in service design come from? Because you did a degree in English followed by a master's in human rights. So What sort of gave you the idea, and did those subjects impact on your career at all?
Yeah, so I think it's evolved gradually. So after leaving university, I did some work that was started out more in marketing and moved into design and user experience design. So I was looking a lot more at the kind of interfaces that users interact with. So the actual buttons that they were clicking and the screens that they were going through, and working with developers in that way. And I expanded in that area and worked in different places on user experience design. And then once I started getting more involved in public sector, this is when my scope kind of broadened, and I was looking more at service design. And service design is particularly important in the public sector because of the, service delivery is the biggest part of what government does. It's the biggest part of what their budgets go on. So it's a really important role there. In the private sector, it's becoming more prevalent, but I'd not seen service design so much in the private sector. So other terms that people might come across is like user experience design, just some similar things to a service designer, might be a little bit more focused on the kind of minute interactions with a particular screen or a particular product. And that's where I started out. In terms of my journey from university, it's been a nice kind of full circle, actually. I think some of the skills that I got from my English degree were to do with critical thinking, research and analysis, and really being able to kind of communicate and construct an argument. They've been really important for me all the way through my career. And then moving into my human rights degree, we did an applied element. So we did a work in South Africa with a charity, and we were looking at how services are delivered from a charity to the community. So it was looking at it from a human rights perspective rather than a delivery perspective, which is more what I do now. But it's actually very similar, because you're looking at the environment, you're looking at the community, you're looking at what they need, and trying to work out how you can best deliver that to them in a way that is going to really resonate with them. So if you're working in a community that doesn't have access to computers and the internet really freely, you're going to have to think about a completely different way to engage with them, whether it's through groups that you hold in a local community centre, or is it through flyers or forms? And that also is what service design does. It's thinking about those people and thinking about how you best deliver for them. So there's been a very nice link back to what I was doing then. And I think that thinking at university has definitely informed what I do now, even though it's not such a kind of logical move.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because I think the obvious thing, you think of human rights, you think sort of activism and helping people where you are like physically seeing them and making a difference in their lives. But actually, it sounds like the sort of essence of thinking about human rights and what is important to an individual, making something accessible, and from what you described earlier, being very sort of person-centered and sort of the end user-centered, it does link really nicely with it, but just in a way that you wouldn't have necessarily imagined.
Yeah, and when I was at university, I'd never heard the term service design. I was actually some years into my career before I heard the term service design. I think it is a very new emerging field. Government really has led the way in that. The UK government is well known around the world for their approach to service design. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that trying to help people where they're at and has very much come out of that master's degree that I did as well.
So you mentioned you work in the tech sector now, but you've worked in health, education, marketing. How common is it for people to move around between sectors like that within this type of service design related roles?
Yeah, so I think you can choose to be a service designer in-house somewhere. So you could choose to go and work at a company and do service design on their products and services. So there's a lot of service design and user-centered designers at the Co-op, for instance. You can choose to do it in-house for a public sector organization. So there's a huge function within government across all sorts of different government departments and the NHS for user-centered designers and researchers. Or you can choose to work in consultancy, which is what I do, which gives you a little bit more flexibility because you get to work in those environments, but you can then step back and go on to another project, which is one of the things that I do really like about consultancy. It's not like working for an agency where you might have kind of five clients on the go. You typically would have one engagement. It might last for a couple of months. It might last to over a year. So it's kind of deep involved work. You're really integrated with the team. and you're typically working with the client rather than kind of delivering something for them. You would be working in kind of a blended multidisciplinary team a lot of the time, and you're all working together towards a common goal, regardless of whether you're there on behalf of a consultancy or on behalf of the organization. And you can, in consultancy, move between sectors if your organization works in different sectors. So you could do some work in NHS, or you might think, I really want to give this a go in the private sector and look at kind of finance and how I could apply some of this thinking in a finance sector. And people do, they kind of take the skills and the experience and apply it in a different sector as a way to kind of develop themselves and grow. I think that's a really good thing because it's kind of a common skill set, but you can really do it in any environment.
That sounds really, I'm sure, attractive to a lot of people to have that flexibility and not having to sort of be like, right, this is where I work now and that's it forevermore kind of thing. But the opportunity to immerse yourself in a project rather than just dipping in and dipping out and really understand what an organization needs must be quite satisfying, I'd imagine. What kind of personal strengths or qualities would you say you need to have to be both sort of successful but also happy as a service designer? Because it sounds like it's a really complex job, requires a lot of different skills. What are the top things that you need to be good at and kind of actually like doing if you're going to get into?
So I think a top one is communication. Service design is often asked as translation points. So I mentioned earlier about the fact that you might be working with developers and you might also be working with designers and you might also be working with kind of people who set policy or represent the business. All of those people are probably speaking quite different languages in terms of the roles that they do. Another one I think is around collaboration and teamwork. So being able to be in a room with a lot of people, you know, it can be a virtual room, and have those conversations. Some people really like to come to work, get their head down, be quiet, get their work done and leave. And that's absolutely fine. But typically that won't happen if you're in a service design role. You are going to be kind of firefighting and jumping from call to call and trying to bring things together. I sometimes have to block out my diary because I really need some thinking space. And then I'll jump back into kind of the calls and that role of collaborative team working. I think if you're working in public sector and on these really, really large scale projects, and also in consultancy, resilience is a really important one because it can be difficult, because the subject matter can be difficult, the time pressures can be difficult, and having to work with a whole new group of people every time you join a project, you may not have never worked with those people before, and that can be challenging as well. So kind of knowing what your own boundaries are and how to kind of take care of yourself if you are having difficulty. So that's one of the things that we do through our own internal community, which is make sure we come back together every week and catch up and see how everybody's getting on in their own projects and just have a conversation about you know, anything interesting to do with kind of design and research. So from a personal quality perspective, I think that's quite important to make sure you're taking care of yourself when things do get challenging.
So by challenging, is that code for, it's quite stressful at times because you've got to meet deadlines. And as you mentioned earlier, you've got to balance the needs of the user with the needs of the person who's asking you to design the service in the first place, maybe budgetary issues as well. Is that what the challenge is to you, or is it something a bit different?
Yeah, I think it can be stressful. There's definitely deadlines. There's definitely fast-paced working. Then there's times where it's not as busy. It's all kind of, it ebbs and flows. It's also the challenges of just working in a group of people, in any workplace, that can be challenging if any conflicts arise. And because we are working so collaboratively, you have more chance for, you know, people don't necessarily own their own domain. You're all building a service together, so you've got to thrash out any of those disagreements that you have so that you can progress. You can't just go away and kind of deal with your segment and deliver it after 8 weeks. You have to kind of show up every day and be working together towards the same common goal to make sure that the project continues successfully, because they are on such tight deadlines. I think the other challenging thing, I suppose, is anything to do with public sector is you're dealing with public money as well. So you want to make sure that you're doing the best job you can for the people who are using the services. And sometimes things get slowed down because of things outside of your control. And that can always be frustrating because you want to make sure that you keep delivering.
So for you personally, what's the thing that you really love about the work that, you know, you've been building your career in this area for quite a few years now? What's the thing that keeps you interested?
I love working in teams. I think that really drives me and keeps me motivated. And I love being able to do some research and identify something that somebody needs and be able to then deliver that for them. Because in this role, you do almost act as a, I don't want to say gatekeeper, but you are kind of that intermediary between somebody in the community and government, and they can't always get their needs met or their voices heard. And you get to hear those voices and then be an advocate to say, listen, we've spoken to people, we've heard this, and we think it's really important that we make a change to the way that the service works to help those people better and to make it easier for them to reach their goal. And then actually getting to put that into practice.
Yeah.
So that, you know, a few weeks down the line or whenever your code is released into live or the change is released, people can then interact with it and it's better than it was before. That's always really satisfying.
Yeah, that must be you. Like basically a problem solver. We've all had those experiences with either like physical services or digital services where it's like, oh, this is so slow, it doesn't work, or it's so frustrating. So the fact that you can actually make those changes and make things better is like, that must be really satisfying.
Yeah.
What's the worst bit then? What's the thing that you kind of feel, oh, I'll put up with this because I get to do the fun bits that I really like?
So one thing I was just thinking there is that I now can't stop service designing things. So I had a really bad toothache at the weekend and I was on the phone to 111 and they kept playing these annoying messages. And I was thinking, well, I wasn't thinking, I was verbalizing. Why do they keep playing the messages? They could play it once and then ask you if you want to hear it again. And you could have a choice as to whether you keep listening to the message. And my friend was sat there and he was going, look, you've got toothache. You don't need to be service designing their phone service. But you do spot things everywhere. So bad form design is a classic. You know, you receive a form that you've got to fill out and you fill it out wrong because the way it's designed and the way it's worded is so complicated that I send it off. And then it comes back to me and they say, you missed this bit. And, you know, from a service design perspective, that's not the user's problem. That's a problem with the design.
It's highlighted the world's imperfections to you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What do you think will be the key challenges for service designers and design ethics then moving forward for students or graduates who are thinking, oh, this sounds really interesting, maybe I want to get into this? What could they be researching or anticipating that things that are sort of going to be on the horizon in the next few years?
Service design is very much a new field, really. It grows out of other disciplines, but a lot of the thinking around service design is still quite new. So there's tons of blogs and fantastic resources out there because the conversation is still ongoing. It's not at all fixed. You know, people come out with new ideas all the time and it changes the conversation. So just service design in general is a really interesting thing to look at as an emerging discipline. But you mentioned design ethics, which is something that I'm really interested in and do a lot of kind of research into. I think one key thing that is coming up constantly at the moment is around AI, and particularly the way the data sets that underpin our AI models and our machine learning models were trained means that they can be discriminatory to people without white skin, to people who aren't men. And there's some fantastic books around this, the work of Joy Bulamwini, who has a TED talk out as well, and also a Netflix documentary called Coded Bias talks all about this. And this is all to do with how we design our AI and how we design our products using AI tools underneath them, and the real conversations and thinking that needs to be done about that to make sure that we don't bring those biases in. Yeah, I think it's going to be really, really important over the next few years.
Thank you. Yeah, that does sound very scary and definitely useful to be thinking about and try and help mitigate against. Have you got any other sort of final bits of advice for students thinking about breaking into service design, particularly for non-tech students like yourself coming from a arts and humanities background, a social sciences background? Anything that's useful to get experience of to see if they, you know, get a taste for it and see if they like it, or is there anything they should do in terms of tech upskilling to be attractive to employers to break into this kind of service design?
Yeah, so service design, user experience design, user research are all really active communities online and also at meetups. So before the pandemic, there were a lot of meetups and they're all starting to come back now. So there's one called Northern UX, for example. I know we're based in the north, and they get together and they have speakers who talk about UX, and it's very chilled out. It's just a way to kind of hear from other people in the industry, discuss ideas, go and listen to kind of a short talk. Yeah, they're fun events as well. It's just kind of quite a low stakes way to learn a little bit more about it, and also maybe network a little bit and ask people there what they do. Blogs is another one. There's so many tech blogs out there, particularly if you kind of search blogs around service design and service design in government, if that's something you're interested in. People really, really frequently share their work. So they will do a piece of work and then they will talk about what happened. And one of the things in service design and in agile methodology is sharing the failures as well as the wins, which I think is really important. People say, this worked, this didn't work, I'd do this differently next time. And they talk about that in blogs. And it's a really good way to kind of learn about what's going on in the day-to-day. So reading that stuff, kind of getting involved in some of the meetups, getting involved in some of the conversations and reaching out. It is a really friendly community from my experience. I go along to some women in tech events that are organised in Leeds, and everyone's just always incredibly friendly and wanting to help out people who are interested in getting involved. So I definitely recommend giving that a try.
Brilliant. And it sounds from what you were saying earlier, you don't need to necessarily have the tech skills. You have to be able to collaborate and research, use your critical thinking, communicate effectively, facilitate, translate. So it's those, a lot of the skills that you would hone through a non-technical degree, as well as I'm sure technical degrees contain that as well, but it's about those broader skills rather than necessarily the technical nitty-gritty of how you code something and design a service.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the NHS and in government, they have frameworks for levels. So there's an associate level, which is absolutely, they're interested in your mindset, what your interests are, and some of those skills around communication and facilitation and team working, you know, and things that you may have got through your degree, they're not expecting to see stuff on your CV yet. They're not expecting to see kind of technical skills necessarily. They are bringing you in at that level so that you can learn from others, work in a team and train up as you go. And that's true of a lot of organizations when they're bringing people in at entry level. They're looking for the right mindset, really. And people who are really interested and engaged and willing to work in a group to deliver something.
Brilliant. Well, for more info about the careers we've mentioned today, I'm going to add some relevant links to the episode description and a link to the full transcript of today's show. But Kate, thank you so much. I now understand what service design is. This is amazing. Really appreciate you taking the time out today. It's been really, really useful and interesting.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been lovely to chat.
Thanks for joining us this week on What Do You Actually Do? This episode was hosted by myself, Kate Morris, and edited and produced by the Careers and Placements team. If you love this podcast, spread the word and subscribe. Are you eager to get more tips? Follow University of York Careers and Placements on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. All useful links are in this episode description. This has been produced at the University of York Careers and Placements. For more information, visit york.ac.uk/careers.